like you to turn with me tonight, please, to the first book of Kings. 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings 8, verse 22. And Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the congregation of Israel, and spread forth his hands toward heaven. Verse 27. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. How much less this house that I have builded. Yet have thou respect unto the prayer of thy servant, and to his supplication, O Lord my God, to hearken unto the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prayeth before thee today, that thine eyes may be opened toward this house night and day, even toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there. If thou mayest hearken unto the prayer which thy servant shall make toward this place, and hearken thou to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel, when they shall pray toward this place, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and when thou hearest, forgive. Verse 33. When thy people Israel be smitten down before the enemy because they have sinned against thee, and shall turn again to thee, and confess thy name, and pray, and make supplication unto thee in this house, then hear thou in heaven, and forgive the sin of thy people Israel, and bring them again unto the land which thou gavest unto their fathers. Then heaven is shut up, and there is no rain, because they have sinned against thee. If they pray toward this place, and confess thy name, and turn from their sins, when thou afflictest them, then hear thou in heaven, and forgive the sin of thy servants, and of thy people Israel, that thou teach them the good way wherein they should walk, and give rain upon thy land which thou hast given to thy people for an inheritance. If there be in the land famine, if there be pestilence, blasting, mildew, locusts, or if there be caterpillars, if their enemy besiege them in the land of their cities, whatsoever plague, whatsoever sickness there be, what prayer and supplication soever be made by any man or by all thy people Israel, which shall know every man the plague of his own heart, and spread forth his hands toward this house, then hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and forgive, and do, and give to every man according to his ways, whose heart thou knowest. For thou, even thou only, knowest the hearts of all the children of men, that they may fear thee all the days that they live in the land which thou gavest unto our fathers. Verse 44, if thy people go out to battle against their enemies, whithersoever thou shalt send them, and shalt pray unto the Lord toward the city which thou hast chosen, and toward the house that I have built for thy name, then hear thou in heaven their prayer and their supplication, and maintain their cause. I believe we have a very, very remarkable message for each and every one of us in a chapter like this. And I'm going to recommend that we each one just take this chapter at home and read it through. Read it each for our own heart, the entire chapter. Here we find King Solomon, that wise and prosperous king. And he looked at this great house which he had built. When he started to build it, he said that it must be exceeding magnificent. And he gathered together such gold and silver. And I'm sure when that house was being built and the grandeur of it developed from day to day, King Solomon must have stood back from time to time and admired the wonder of this mighty, glorious, fabulous temple. Day by day, its glory grew before his eyes, and at last this magnificent temple was finished. And then Solomon looked up. And I have no doubt as he looked upward, he realized how very insignificant compared to the God of heaven was this most magnificent temple that had been built. so he prays, and I have often felt the wisdom of this prayer of Solomon is something that I need to read and bow before again and again. Solomon looked upon God's beloved people. He knew that they were God's beloved, chosen, earthly people. He knew that this grand and wondrous temple was for the name and the glory of the Lord. He knew it had been erected in the place where the Lord had chosen to set his name. But notice the way he prays. Solomon looked around upon the people, and Solomon, I believe, also realized the dangerous tendencies of his own heart, and so the trend of his prayer. He looked at these people, and he foresaw that which might so easily befall them. And he saw the one and only reason why anything of this sort ever would befall them. And that reason certainly was not the lack of power or of care on the part of God to defend and to prosper his people. But he foresaw the great danger that his own heart and the hearts of God's people might be turned away from that God, that they might fall into that which would be grieving to the heart of God himself. And so he looked upon the danger of their being oppressed by their enemies. He looked, too, upon the danger of a multitude of things befalling God's own beloved people. Isn't that unusual? Is that strange? When you love someone very, very much, surely you would shelter and protect them from all harm and all danger, would you not? And yet I'm sure that the heart of every mother and of every father has realized that there have been times when you and I have had to act in this same manner toward our own dear children. Or am I the only one that has the memory of such things befalling me when I was a boy? I have had to go and stand in the corner and miss my supper because of my bad behavior. Did my father love me? I know very well he did. All I know is I stood in the corner with my hands behind my back and my head bowed and feeling rather hungry and sorry for myself. I tried to persuade myself that Dad didn't love me very well, or he wouldn't do that to me. But I knew just the same that he did. And I'm very glad that he did. And before the Lord took him from us, I thanked him for every time that his hand of discipline had been brought down upon me. He loved me, I know he did. And so Solomon, wise man that he was, looked upward to heaven and realized that the hand of God might well come upon these people so beloved of the Lord if they acted in carelessness or disobedience or sinful ways. And he also had the foreknowledge to recognize that not one thing would befall the people of Israel, from the harassment of mighty enemy armies to the invasion of caterpillars. Not one of these things would trouble the land unless the Lord allowed it. You know, dear brethren, I feel, I speak personally, that it's because we pay little heed to the lesson of the caterpillars that we sometimes have to learn the lesson of invading armies. Those little things that we are so apt to say, well, this kind of thing happens to everybody. I don't think there's any special voice from the Lord for me in this. Oh, indeed there is. Solomon knew that not one caterpillar would cross the boundaries of the land of Israel unless the Lord allowed it. And he knew that there would be a reason and a lesson to be learned. Caterpillar, locust, blasting, mildew, famine, armies, everyone from the greatest to the least, Solomon recognized as a voice from the Lord. I wonder if it is not true that we very, very often take the little adversities as simply being a matter of course. But the great things we sometimes are inclined to say, I wonder what the Lord is trying to teach me in this. It's not for me to say what the lesson is for anyone else, but it is for me to say what the lesson might be for my own heart. I remember my father telling me that he was visiting a dear brother in Brooklyn, New York, many years ago. The brother had had a fire in the attic of his home, and the whole roof had been burned off. Well, the brother, I guess, took it as a matter of course and rebuilt the roof, just got it nicely finished and shingled, and lightning struck the roof and set it on fire and burned it off the second time. And my father came around to visit the dear brother when he was just finishing rebuilding his roof for the second time. He was pretty well downcast at this turn of events. And he was saying, "Brother Hayho, whatever has been the reason for this? Twice the roof of my home has been burned off." My father said, "Brother, I don't know the reason, but I do know that the hand of the Lord is in it." Now, he said, "I'm going to ask you a question. Which one of Jacob's sons had the most trouble in his life?" "Well," he said, "I guess probably Joseph did. If you had the choice of being one of Jacob's sons, which one would you like to have been?" He said, "I would like to have been Joseph." "Well," he said, "Joseph didn't know why these troubles came upon him one after the other. You know, and I know now as we read the account, what a marvelous picture and lesson was behind all this. But dear Joseph didn't know it at the time." And I tell you, beloved saints of God, when I read this prayer of King Solomon, then I see the discernment given to this dear man, that he would recognize, I say again, that not one caterpillar would ever cross the boundaries of the land of Israel without the hand of God being in it. I think I ought to bow my head and say, "Lord, help me to learn the lessons that are intended for me in the little circumstances that are sent of God just as truly as the great trials and problems." I feel very often that these great trials and problems would not be needed, perhaps, if we would learn the lessons from the lesser ones. Perhaps the famine would not come if we learned the lesson of the caterpillar. Perhaps the armies would never invade the land if we learned the lesson of the locust. And so, dear saints of God, let me just suggest to my own heart and to each and every one of us that the circumstances that the Lord brings to you and to me individually, or in our family experience, or in our assembly experience, are intended as lessons from the Lord, that we might realize that which Solomon foresaw, there was something the Lord was trying to teach his people. Notice, please, the 38th verse of this chapter, this prayer. "What prayer and supplication soever be made by any man or by all my people Israel." Isn't that instructive? I think I should lay my finger on those words, "any man." I have no doubt it would be pleasing to the Lord if all Israel would take the lesson to heart. But even if all Israel doesn't take it to heart, Solomon says, "Lord, if there's any man in Israel that will realize that there is a voice intended in that which has been allowed, and will bow and own his part in it, Lord, hear the prayer of that man." Wouldn't I like to be that man? Wouldn't you like to be that man? Do you think that this was a foolish, wasted prayer of King Solomon? I don't believe it was. I believe it was a wise prayer. It is recorded here by inspiration in order that you and I might learn a needful lesson. Ah, when we see Israel in difficulty in the days of Ezra and of Nehemiah, what do we hear from the heart and lips of, I believe it's Ezra? Pardon me a moment while I turn to see whether it was Ezra or Nehemiah who prayed, I believe it was Nehemiah. Yes, Nehemiah chapter 1. We can read this later at our leisure. Nehemiah chapter 1, from verse 4 to the end of the chapter, I believe we see there the heart of a man who loved God's people very, very dearly His heart was really burdened because of the oppression of God's people. And whose heart is poured out in that prayer? The heart of Nehemiah. Whose guilt is owned in that prayer? The guilt of Nehemiah. And if we return to the book of Daniel, we would find the same thing. And at approximately the same time, too, there was Daniel numbered among the captives in the land of Babylon. And he realizes that they would never be in that situation unless the Lord had a lesson for them to learn. And what does Daniel say? He bows his head and prays as though he were the Jonah in the whole situation, as though this had befallen Israel because of his, Daniel's, own sad failure. Oh, when I read of such men as Nehemiah and Daniel, and when I read such words as these, I feel that the prayer, the desire of my heart in these last days of waiting ought to be, Lord, make me a Daniel. Lord, make me a Nehemiah that would bow and own that there is indeed the hand of the Lord upon his beloved people, but the heart of the Lord toward us in tender love and in the desire for blessing. Oh, dear fellow saints of God, does Satan ever whisper in your ear that perhaps the love and the care of God is not what it once was or what it ought to be? Oh, may God grant that each and every one of us may realize and never doubt the wondrous, unchanging, faithful, loving heart of God toward us. Whatever he may pass me or my family or you or your loved ones through, I do believe, dear saints of God, that there is intended for every one of us a lesson of his faithful love. You know, I'm sure you do, you wouldn't deny for a moment that he wants you and me to have a happy life, an abundant entrance, and a full reward. Is this so? Is this the experience of every one of us? Oh, you say there are certain folks in such circumstances that they just couldn't have a happy life. Is that really true? I'm sure I'm not the only one here who has visited with those whose circumstances are most unenviable, and yet their happiness and their joy in the Lord causes us to bow our heads in amazement. I'm sure most of you have heard this statement. Happiness is a state of soul and not a question of circumstances. I think a good many have heard that, but I've heard it more often than you have. Because my dad used to say it over and over again. Happiness is a state of soul and not a question of circumstances. And I repeat, the desire of God's heart is for you and me and all his people that we might have a happy life, an abundant entrance, and a full reward. If there is a lack in any of this, the lack is found, I believe, right here, and I believe that the reading of a chapter such as this, dear fellow believer, would be a very good and wholesome exercise for us. Suppose we see this perhaps carried out in the history of Israel in 1 Samuel. Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4. Samuel chapter 4, verse 2. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. So people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwelt between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And when the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. Suppose we stop here and consider what we have read already. Here we find the Israelites, God's beloved people, surrounded by enemies that hated them with a bitter hatred. The Philistines and Israel are face to face, ready to do battle. Which are the people particularly beloved of God? The Israelites are God's beloved people. The Philistines are the enemies of God's beloved people. And what happens? When they join battle, Israel is smitten before the Philistines. And there were, on that occasion, 4,000 men slain in battle. Now the elders come and they say, why has the Lord smitten us? That's a good comment to make. They didn't really blame it on the might of the Philistines. They realized that this had something to do with the Lord. So what do they suggest? I think the reading of this third verse has a very solemn lesson. The latter half of the verse. Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. So they bring the ark. Hophni and Phinehas, those two sad sons of Samuel, those guilty men, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And when the ark of the covenant of God appears among Israel, they shout with a great shout. Oh, again, I say, I believe there is a sad condition described here. They fetch it. It may be that it will save us. And when it, the ark, appears, they shout with a great shout, ready for the battle, expecting triumph and victory. Beloved, I don't believe we have any occasion to shout in this manner until we reach home. And then we can shout with all our hearts. We'll thank him then, beloved, for the mighty victory which he has wrought. But I believe that as long as we are here, there ought to be the fear of the Lord and that quiet confidence in him. Not the shout of triumph, not the shout of confidence, but the waiting upon the Lord, which we may find as we turn over a few chapters. I believe there's danger in that which we see described here. They fetch the ark that it might save them. There is a danger, as I hope I am somewhat aware of it in my own heart, that this condition might well creep into this heart of mine, and perhaps I might not be the only one. That word, it may be, tend to both in that which in the sovereign, matchless grace of God has been entrusted to some of his beloved, redeemed people here. The wondrous joy, the unspeakable privilege, beloved saints of God, in being gathered to his own precious name. Have I any right to speak of this with gladness? Indeed I do. I thank God with all my heart as I stand here, that I am not only redeemed with the precious and eternity in the courts of glory with my beloved Savior, together with all the redeemed from every kindred, tongue, people, and nation, but I do thank God that here, today, as I stand among you in San Diego, I am thankful to be gathered to the precious name of the Lord Jesus Christ. But I trust I recognize the danger that I see here in this fourth chapter. I believe there was an element of boasting attached to that which they possessed. It may be that it will save us. Bring it, and then all will be well. When it was among them, they shouted with a great shout, oh, beloved, I say again, God would never, never put in his precious word instructions as to the joy of being gathered to his precious name, the wonderful privilege of being able to remember him in death until he comes, and then deprive us of such a privilege. But on the other hand, I repeat the warning that my own soul needs so much. There is a danger in that which we see described here. Israel, unaware of their own condition before God, boasted and shouted as they went forth to battle against their enemies. It is no time for boasting, beloved. It's no time for shouting. It's a time to be bound on our knees with gladness of heart, indeed with gladness of heart, But notice what happened. Verse 6, and when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of the Lord was coming to the camp, and the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God is coming to the camp." And they said, "Woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight." And the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, and they fled every man into his tent. And there was a very great slaughter, for there fell Israel 30,000 footmen. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. What a sad picture. The ark taken from them, Hophni and Phinehas slain, and Israel crushed and defeated. It surely had been no time for boasting or for shouting. But in the rest of the chapter, I believe there is a lesson that we also need to remember. Suppose we come down to the 15th verse. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were dim that he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, "I am he that came out of the army, and I fled today out of the army." And he said, "What have they done, my son?" And the messenger answered and said, "Israel is fled before the Philistines, and there hath been also a great slaughter among the people, and thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken." And it came to pass that he made mention of the ark of God, that he fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck broke, and he died. For he was an old man and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Sad ending to this dear old man, Eli. And yet, that which was said of him at his death seemed to have a voice for me. This dear old man heard that both his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were killed in battle, and that the ark of God was taken. And it came to pass when he heard that Hophni and Phinehas were dead, he fell. Is that what it says? No, it doesn't. It came to pass when he heard that the ark of God was taken, he fell backward. Oh, beloved, here was a man whose two sons were slain in battle, and he hears about it. He also hears that the ark of God was taken. What affected him the most? What was the real desire of the heart of this dear old man with all his failures? The ark of God. That meant more to him than his own two sons.
You know, sometimes, beloved, when situations arise that are very, very testing and trying and difficult for us, we find ourselves much more inclined to be affected and to be influenced by the ties of nature that we find here in this little story, and perhaps the ark of God, perhaps the glory of God, is liable to take second place, third place, or even less. That which stirred the heart of this dear old man with all the failures that had been characteristic of his life, that which characterized him at the end was a deep value for the ark of God and the testimony of the Lord. Oh, may it be so with us. We're just about at the end of the journey. We're going to be called home, and for this we thank God. In this we rejoice, beloved, that, oh, I ask my heart, may I ask yours also, what is the real and deep desire of your heart and mine while we wait for that glorious moment? Does your heart and mind really long for the blessing of the Lord upon his beloved people? For that testimony which he, in sovereign, matchless grace, has raised up and has maintained and will soon call home to be with himself? Is this, dearly beloved brothers, dearly beloved sisters, is this that which causes you and me such deep and earnest prayer? I hope it may be so. Notice also, please, the same thing in connection with the wife of Phinehas, verse 19. His daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child, near to be delivered. And when she heard the tidings that the ark of God was taken, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and travailed, for her pain came upon her. And at the time of her death, the woman that stood by said unto her, Fear not, for thou hast borne a son. But she answered not, neither did she regard it. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, The glory is departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her daughter-in-law and her husband. And she said, The glory is departed from Israel, the ark of God is taken. Here was a sister who heard in one day, My husband is dead. My brother-in-law is dead. My uncle is dead. The ark of God is also taken. And what affected her the most? The news that the ark of God was taken. Call my son Ichabod, the glory is departed from Israel. Oh, beloved, I have read this alone again and again. I feel it's a lesson that my own soul needs. May God grant that this poor, cold-hearted mind may have a deeper value for that which is to the delight and the glory of God while we wait for that moment when we shall be called home. The wife of Phinehas, as well as dear old Eli, had such a heart for the ark of God, the testimony of God, that it meant more to them than life itself. They both died that same day. And they both left behind them the testimony that they loved and valued that which was for the glory of God as long as they were here. They left that testimony with their dying words. Oh, beloved, I tell you, it's a joy to be here in San Diego again. It's a joy to go here and there among the saints of God and to find that by His matchless grace, not according to our deserts, not according to our faithfulness, but according to His matchless, sovereign grace, a testimony is maintained. And I'll tell you, it is a sad and deep grief to go to a place where once there was a testimony and find that the candlestick is gone. It ought to be a grief. It ought to be a sorrow. It's a grief to His heart. Oh, beloved, I look into your face tonight and I say to each and every one of us present, may God grant that this may be real and precious to your heart, to mine, for it's real and precious to Him. Christ also loved the church and shed His blood for it. Did I quote that correctly? No, I didn't. Christ also loved the church and died for it. Is that the way it reads? No. Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for it. Oh, what wondrous depth of meaning we find in words like these. Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for it. You say, I am a living stone in that church. Yes, thank God you are. Just as truly a living stone as Paul or Peter. But what a wonderful privilege it is, dear saints of God, to see the glad liberty given to us of expressing such a truth while we are yet here. Of expressing the truth that we are members of His body, that we are living stones in that church for which He gave Himself. And as we see by the matchless grace of God, flickering testimonies here and there, still valuing, still displaying that wondrous truth here. We thank God for it, but we thank God with bowed heads and I trust with humble hearts. For we realize that if it were a matter of our own faithfulness, there would be nothing left. You know, when I visited Japan about 9 years ago, dear Brother Yamanaka said, I would like, dear brother, to take you to visit among the few who are gathered to the name of the Lord Jesus in this land. But he said, please remember this. that if you see anything that seems to be a work of the Lord, it's not because of Brother Yamanaka, it's in spite of Brother Yamanaka. And I believe he meant that with all sincerity. I believe it was the expression of a humble brother. If you see any sign of a work of the Lord, it's not because of Brother Yamanaka, it's in spite of Brother Yamanaka. But I believe, dear saints of God, that as you and I read the account of a man like Eli and a woman like Phinehas' wife, we see here a lesson that might well challenge the heart of any one of us. Could we turn over now to this same book, chapter 7? Verse 2. And it came to pass, while the ark abode in Kirjath-Jearim, that the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the ark. Excuse me for making mistakes once in a while, but I think it rather emphasizes what the scripture really tells us. You would expect this verse to say that, would you not? Here the ark has been 20 years in Kirjath-Jearim, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Oh, I like this. Here is a change over that which we saw in chapter 3. Let us fetch the ark. It may be that it will deliver us out of the hand of the enemy. But now we find them lamenting after the Lord. Oh, dear fellow believer, is this the attitude of your heart and mine? Is there, as we find ourselves surrounded by enemies and encompassed with difficulties, is there that which we find in verse 2 in our hearts? Is there this longing after the honor and the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ? Is there any danger that I personally might wish to be vindicated rather than seeing that which we find in this verse? Oh, beloved saints of God, I think there's a wonderful indication in the expression found here, lamented after the Lord. And Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel. Ah, this is wonderful. Samuel. I like to look back to the early history of this mighty prophet, Samuel. For I believe there is a lesson in the early childhood of this dear boy. You remember, in the first chapter and the last verse, perhaps we might just take a look at it, the language of the mother of dear Samuel, chapter 1, verse 28. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord, and he worshipped the Lord there. That's a good verse. Three times the name of the Lord is mentioned. And the last word in the verse is there. There was nowhere else that that mother could take her child that he might have the reality of the presence of the Lord except there. There. There and there only could she bring her son in order that she might fulfill that which was the real desire of her heart. But three times the name of the Lord is mentioned before the place is mentioned. We thought of this morning as we were reading in our chapter the remarkable expression, Judas also knew the place. I think that's a bit challenging to read a statement like that. Judas also knew the place. Now, I think, my dear brethren, realize that I love and I value and I thank God for the place of his appointment, I hope, as heartily and as earnestly as others of my brethren. I love to own the fact that God, in his matchless sovereign grace, has established and has maintained, according to his faithfulness, a place where we can be gathered to his precious name. But once in a while, someone gets a little bit disturbed, if not downright annoyed, because they hear great emphasis on the place, and sometimes they come to me and say, Brother, I think there's far too much emphasis on the place. I will say that usually folks who speak that way are rather loose in their Christian testimony. However, when I read this last verse of 1 Samuel 1, I think, there's something for us to learn here.
Three times over, the Lord is mentioned before mention is made of the little word there with all that it signifies. And I believe, dear fellow child of God, if you and I simply, shall I say, have before us a certain specific place, that may lead us to be very, very bigoted. But if you and I have before us the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, and we realize that in order to be gathered around himself, we will be found in the place of his appointment where he has set his name, I believe then all will be well. But would you like to put yourself in the shoes of Samuel's mother and see what she had to face? Samuel's mother, she takes a child to this place where Samuel, where Eli served the Lord. Eli, an old man, half blind, that couldn't even control his own family and had no understanding of the heart of a little boy. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, what kind of men were they? You know what kind they were. They're described here. Their conduct is laid bare. What kind of testimony would this be for a boy like Samuel? His mother might well have held back and said, I'm not going to take my boy to that place. Here's old Eli that doesn't have any understanding of a boy. Talk about a generation gap. Eli and Samuel, and Eli's two sons, what will my son hear? What will he see if he's left in their company? There was one thing that made that mother wish to have her boy in that place, and that was the Lord was there, and she counted on the Lord for her boy. Did the Lord answer her prayers? Did the Lord honor her faith? He did, beloved. She took him that he might be in the presence of the Lord. He knew that in doing so there was only one place she could take her boy. True, she knew that he would seek and hear that which must be distressing to him and to her also. She knew that there might be very little understanding of his boy's heart there, but she knew the Lord was there, and she counted on that. And beloved, when I turn to chapter 7, and I read the wonderful testimony of Samuel, don't you think that we could say today, Lord, make me a Samuel among the people of God? And could we, beloved father, beloved mother, could we say this of our dear children, make my son a Samuel? Could the mothers here look upon their son and cry to God that in spite of all the tendencies that might be hard for you or for your dear children to see around, that you could pray that your son might be a Samuel in the midst of it? Samuel had a hard time, and his mother must have had a hard time to see her son surrounded by that which he must have experienced there, but she had him brought into the presence of the Lord at a very early age. And now we find in chapter 7, Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if ye do return to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. And the children of Israel did put away Balaam and Ashtaroth, and serve the Lord only. Would we like victory? Would we like deliverance from enemies? Would we like the blessing of the Lord? It's a challenge. See what they did? They put away these strange gods which had been such a hindrance to them, and they served the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you out of the water. They gathered together to Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord. Isn't this a contrast to what we read in chapter 3? There's no boasting here. There's no shouting here. There's no it will deliver us here. There is the putting away of that which had been a hindrance, and God knew all about it. There was the pouring forth of water upon the ground, and there was the crying before the Lord. Fasted on that day. Fasted. fasting has no place today, does it? Yes, indeed it does. Does that surprise you? I believe that fasting ought to have a much greater place in this day than you or I ever hear anything about. I must admit, I am a little surprised to think that I never hear anything about it. I wonder if the reason could be this, and perhaps it's quite a correct reason too, that we ought never, never to fast because someone told us we should. I believe that it is right and proper for saints of God to fast in days like these. And I have no doubt that everyone here has probably fasted on some occasion or another. Now, I put it this way. Suppose my dear wife had been carried off to the hospital this afternoon critically ill, and the doctor, after making an examination, shook his head and said, I don't know whether she'll make it or not. Maybe by 10 o'clock tonight, 11 o'clock tonight, we'll reach a crisis, and then we'll know, but I don't know whether she's going to make it. I would have gone home and sat down to a good square meal, wouldn't I? You know very well I would. You know that I wouldn't have eaten a bite from the time the doctor said that till that hour, 11 o'clock, perhaps not for a long time after. Why? Because I think the Lord would hear me better on an empty stomach, I'm saying that in plain language. No, but because my heart would be so burdened about one who is dear to me, that the last thing I would want to do is sit down and eat a square meal. I would spend that time on my knees in prayer. And I have no doubt that there are those here, brothers and sisters, who know something of fasting, and perhaps you never thought of it as fasting. But that's what it is. If there is a burden on your heart or mind, perhaps for a loved one, perhaps something of our own condition that we are aware of before God, perhaps the ark of God in danger, we might say. You mean to say that fasting is out of place? It's not out of place, beloved. I'm not calling on anyone to fast. But I am saying this, that when I read that Israel fasted, I feel that you and I can well remember it as something quite in order for our present experience. When the dear servant of God was sent forth, they fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them. And I believe this kind of thing still has its place today. They fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord, and then we will judge the children of Israel in Mizpah. And when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel were gathered together to Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel, same enemy again, just as powerful as ever they had been. And when the children of Israel heard it, they shouted with a great shout. I've read it wrong again. They were afraid of the Philistines. Bravado had no place in the walk of the believer. I believe you and I ought to recognize that there are around us continually enemies that could overwhelm us if it were not for the good and faithful hand of God. And the children of Israel said to Samuel, cease not to cry to the Lord our God for us, that Now, isn't this good? That he will save us out of the hand of the Philistines. And Samuel took a sucking lamb and offered it for a burnt offering wholly unto the Lord. And Samuel cried unto the Lord for Israel. The Lord heard him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But, just that one little word, but, the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines and discomfited them, and they were smitten before Israel. Verse 13. So the Philistines were subdued, and they came no more into the coast of Israel, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. There are lessons, beloved, for my own heart in those passages which we have read this evening. I believe that bravado and boasting and shouting has no place whatever among the saints of God. There is a danger that it might so easily creep into our hearts. You know, the devil has some very successful weapons, and I think two of them are pride and despair. Pride and despair. fair. Suppose I came back to San Diego and I found that this place was so packed that you were planning to buy a new place or double the size of this one. I know what would happen. At least I know what would happen if it were Smith Falls instead of San Diego. We would be patting ourselves on the back and we would be quite inclined to boast. But things were going so well and numbers were being increased, and we would be just ready for an awful calamity. Or else when things are very, very fine, very testing, very difficult, out comes that other weapon, despair. It's time to give up. We've got nothing to cause our hearts to rejoice. Beloved, He is the same yesterday and today and forever. And as we read of His ways with Israel, as we see the prayer of that dear man Solomon, recognizing that everything from a caterpillar to a host of enemies was allowed of the Lord and would never, never come unless there were a stake which God had seen. And there He pleads that if any man in Israel, oh, can we not pray, Lord, make me that man. Any man in Israel, or if all Israel were to bow, knowing the pledge of my own heart, would the Lord hear that prayer? He would, beloved. He would hear that prayer. He would indeed. And so we find in 1 Samuel 3, Israel surrounded by, invaded by their enemies. And they boast as to their possession of the ark. They shout with confidence and boasting, and they are crushed with defeat. But even in that defeat, I feel there is the lesson which we tried to point out in the case of Eli and in the case of the West Phinehas. That which was the deepest concern of all else in their hearts was the glory of God as typified in that talk. It meant more to them than family ties. Oh, beloved, when testing times such as these come, and some of us have known something of it, when family ties tug one way and the glory of God tugs the other, may we remember Eli and the wife of Phinehas. And then, thank God, we can turn to that seventh chapter and see a broken, a bound, a fasting, a repentant people saying, cease not the cry of the Lord for us. And the Lord heard them. The Lord brought them a mighty victory. And all the days of Samuel, they were preserved from the might of their enemies. Oh, when I read that word, Samuel, and I see the godliness of that dear man as he rose up among Israel and led them to bow their heads in fasting and prayer, I think of that dear little boy left in the company of Eli and Eli's son. But he was left because the Lord was there. That's what his mother wanted him to do. Oh, may God grant that in these last days of waiting, by God's matchless grace, there may be with us that bowed head, that fasting in heart and ways, but that rejoicing, beloved, not boasting, but rejoicing. Oh, my father used to say so often, I have so much to praise the Lord for, but I have nothing to boast of. May I say this? I believe I can say it in truth. I have seen my father bowed and crushed with tears and weeping over the sorrows that he met among the people of God as he journeyed from year to year. At home he would groan and weep and pray for the people of God, so dear to his heart. But when he came to me and opened this wonderful book, you wouldn't think he had a care in the world. I mean it. He'd open that book and his heart would just be joy. And the memory that I have of my dad is a man that rejoiced in the Lord. All he had sorrows, he had tears, for he loved his brethren. He loved the people of God. Their sorrows were his sorrows. But he knew that there was one who was the same yesterday and today and forever. And he could rejoice in the Lord always. So can you, beloved. So can I, by the grace of God.
I don't shed tears for God's people, there's something wrong with my heart. But if I don't rejoice in the Lord, there's something wrong with you too. And you can do the same. You and I, by God's matchless grace, as we wait for that moment of your return, and rejoice in the Lord, always. And as Paul says, again I say, rejoice.